table discussion. What we want to achieve by that is we think it's a great opportunity to bring together filmmakers, producers, and scholars, and to find out how, and I'm going to introduce you in a moment, how you have negotiated your artistic ambitions when making your films and the demands of the public funding bodies and the marketplace in the construction of diasporic family on screen. And also, we want to explore how these films intervene with ongoing media debates about hegemonic and minority cultures in Western society. So that's the purpose of our discussion here today. And just to tell you a little bit about the format that Zarita and I envisaged, we assume that you haven't seen all of the films. For example, Feo Aladag's film When We Leave, we will see tonight, and Zandia Azuri's film Eye for India, you've just had a chance to watch. Most of you will have seen West is West. And Gareth, his film is not about a diasporic family, Desire. We will see a clip of that as well. So a few clips at the beginning after the introductions, and then we will launch into the discussion. So let me just begin by introducing Feo Aladag. Feo was born in Vienna. She studied acting in London and Vienna, and she also studied psychology and communication science and graduated with a PhD from the University of Vienna in 2000. In the early 1990s, Feo worked as a freelance editor for daily Austrian newspapers, and she wrote mainly on film and television. Since 1994, Feo has been working as a stage and screen actress in Germany and Austria, and she's also worked on numerous commercials and videos, and amongst other things for Amnesty International, which I think is quite important as a background to the film When We Leave. She has written numerous scripts, also several episodes for Tatort, which is Germany's most popular television crime series. At the European Film Academy, Feo took directorial masterclasses with Michael Radford and Mike Figgis, and she then went on to study directing at the German Film and Television Academy in Berlin. She has continued working as an actress in well over 60 films and television and stage productions. In 2005, Feo Aladag and her husband Züli Aladag founded the film production company Independent Artists Film Produktion, based in Berlin. When We Leave, that a film that we can see later at 6 o'clock at the Cine Lumière, is Feo Aladag's cinema debut as producer, scriptwriter, and director. And her film has garnered countless awards. I can't list them all, including 2 German Film Awards for Best Actress and Best Film, the European Lux Film Prize, the Best Film at Tribeca Film Festival, and many more. And it was also Germany's nomination for the Academy Awards this year.
And if I can introduce Leslie Adwin. Leslie Adwin was born in Tel Aviv and spent her formative years in Cape Town and Johannesburg, where she studied drama and acting. She moved to the UK in 1979 and first worked as an actress at the Birmingham Rep Theatre and later at the National Theatre, the Royal Court and the RSC. Leslie appeared in many television series, including the soap opera El Dorado, I certainly remember it, In Suspicious Circumstances and The Bill. In 1990, Leslie produced the documentary Who Bombed Birmingham for Granada Television about the trial of the Birmingham Six. To date, Leslie has produced 4 feature films, East is East, the rom-com The One and Only, Mrs. Ratcliffe's Revolution, about a British family who relocates to East Germany, in 1968, and West is West. East is East, about a Pakistani-British family based in Salford in the early 1970s, is one of Britain's most successful films ever, earning more than £10 million in the UK box office alone, and another $4 million in America. It also won the Alexander Korda BAFTA Award for the Best British Film in 2000, and Leslie's going to be showing us a clip, I believe, shortly.
Of West is West, the sequel.
Of West is West, yes. Sandhya Suri received a scholarship to study documentary at the National Film and Television School. Her graduation film, Safar, was shown to numerous international festivals and received the jury special mention at Cinema du Real and the award for Best Short Film at the British Film Institute's Imagine Asia Festival. Sandhya has, as we know, lived and worked in the UK, Germany, India and Japan, and worked on documentary projects in Africa, South America, and Polynesia. Eye for India is her first feature-length documentary. It's won many awards, including Best Documentary at the Indian Film Festival at LA, at the Asian Festival of First Films, at the Karachi International Film Festival, the Silver Award for Films South Asia, and was in the official selection of the Sundance Film Festival in 2006.
And Gareth Jones is a television and film director, producer, and writer, and his many productions for television have focused in particular on multicultural and Holocaust concerns, with films such as The Trial of Klaus Barbie, Shalom Salam, and the documentary on Christianity and Judaism, Au Nom de Mon Père. And he also did a feature on Bonhoeffer, Die letzte Stufe, about German resistance. He's a film consultant working in four languages for institutions across Europe, and he has his own production company, Scenario Films. He regularly teaches at the German Film and Television Academy in Berlin, and at the Marubi Film School in Tirana and Euromat, and a lot of other places. Earlier this week, Gareth was awarded a PhD from Cambridge University for his study on trauma and Holocaust films. Gareth will show us a clip from his German feature film, Desire, in a moment. As I said, it's not about a diasporic family, but it's about a white middle-class family and their intimate relationship or fantasies. I shouldn't give away too much, with an au pair from Francophone Africa. Gareth is at this round table primarily because he has founded in 2007 a very interesting project, and he's also director of that project. It's called Babylon. And Babylon is an audiovisual development program which assists filmmakers of migrant and diasporic origin, principally from the European periphery, but it has now expanded and there's an African dimension, I mean, a kind of an African Babylon International exists now as well. And it helps them to enhance their script and story development skills and production techniques. Babylon runs intensive workshops, often or normally at film festivals, and helps filmmakers access the international marketplace via the program's network of industry consultants, which include funders and international sales agents and distributors. So if we could just invite Leslie and Gareth to very briefly say something about these scenes that we've seen. Leslie?
They look terrific. Anyway.
Oh, thank you. I guess I chose the scenes because they seem to me to go to the heart of the themes and issues that are the subject of this wonderful conference today. By the way, thank you very much for having me here. The history of the relationship between George Khan and Ella, Mrs. Khan number two, is a real history. As Claudia mentioned in her, where is Claudia? Yeah. It was a very incisive, thrilling paper that you did. Thank you so much for that. And I please can I have a copy of it? Ayub Khan Din, the writer, would just love that. He would. I mean, it's just great to have such critical faculty brought, you know, in such an incisive and illuminating way to one's intentions, because, you know, in feature films, you're kind of dealing with crass criticism most of the time and nothing that is that intelligent and insightful. So thank you so much for that. I was not just impressed, I was very moved by it, actually. I was very touched by it. Thank you. So it is, as Claudia told you earlier, it is a real story. Ayub's parents did form the basis of these two characters. His father did leave Kashmir, in fact, though we've set it in the Pakistani Punjab. He left Kashmir, leaving a wife and daughters behind, with the intention of coming back, just supporting the family. Fell in love with this bus conductress on a Salford bus. He used to ride the buses. She told her kids that she used to see this man constantly on her route, on her bus, and it's because he had fallen in love with her and was literally just riding the bus in order to be in her presence. And they fell in love and married and did an incredibly courageous thing back then in Salford. She was called a prostitute on the streets for just being with a brown-skinned man. They were the only Asian family on the street. They were incredibly isolated. George had the right, of course, to take a second wife. So, you know, this wasn't a problem for him culturally. And nor was it a problem for all those years he was away when he thought he was managing the situation perfectly well. His only problems were in England, his children not being respectful enough of his traditions and his cultural values. But of course, when he comes back after 30 years, it's he who has a lot to learn and has to come of age. Although ostensibly in the film we're following the young boy's coming of age, but, you know, by sleight of hand it very soon becomes the father's. So I guess, yeah, I chose these two scenes. I mean, from an expositionary point of view, the scene between the husband and Mrs. Khan, number two, is very to the point of diasporic families. The other scene seems to me to be the very soul and pulse of the film, the heart of it, which is that we are all people and our stories are the same wherever we come from. This film has rather shockingly become a kind of political football in a lot of senses, and I'm reeling with disbelief of what particularly American distributors have said about the film. We'll come to that perhaps a bit later. It's fascinating and very troubling. But I'm on a kind of personal mission with the film, I guess. I mean, I've been usually a producer delivers the film and then, you know, moves on. I delivered it last July and I've been with it constantly round the clock ever since then, without any, you know, further fees being payable or anything. I'm about to go to India tonight to support the Indian release, which starts in 3 weeks' time, because it's become such a kind of impassioned piece of work for me. And I guess, yeah, the scene between the two wives is very much the sort of heartbeat of the expression of what I care most about in this film, which is, you know, this communication across the language barriers, across the cultural divides, across the, and the two women, you know, both the victims of the tyranny of George Khan in many ways, coming together in that extraordinary, I think, you know, just an amazing scene. Is that enough? Yeah, it's too much.
Gareth, the scene that the audience has just seen.
Don't make the same mistake, don't talk so long.
I hope that one scene will have given you some idea of the film. The scene probably speaks for itself. The film is an exploration, not of the diasporic family, but of the West London family. Faced with the diasporic experience, if you like, but we discover through it that we're all on inner diasporas of one sort or another, and that our family structure is constantly reinventing itself. And this is not a study of dysfunctional families, it's a study of a very highly functioning and extremely differentiated family and the various moves that it goes with when it opens up to welcome a new member. With somewhat explosive consequences, as you'll probably guess, but nonetheless not dysfunctional. Desire is not a dysfunctional facet of our life, it is a requisite of our life, and it's a very highly thematic film in that sense. It's a very intimate film in almost every sense. There are only four characters and two children in the piece, and it does actually never leave that house. It's 90 minutes, a feature film contained within four walls. Just to give you some idea of the trajectory of the film, we opened at the Sarajevo Film Festival about 2 years ago, did the Continental Film Festival circuit, and we're just completing a modest but nonetheless 15-city UK release. So the film has been noticed, fairly mixed responses, but generally actually quite favourable, and I rather hope it will form a potential model for a new independent British cinema of ideas and intimate life, if you like, a kind of cinema for the age of austerity.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. We're launching into the discussion. What, of course, all your films have in common is that they focus on the family. And the most obvious question, therefore, is to all of you, what made you interested in the family? Maybe starting with Zandia,
Just looking at Theo. For some reason, don't know why. Well, mine was, quite obvious in a way, so it's probably the easiest answer or the most obvious answer, but actually, in terms of documentary, the genre of personal documentary isn't really one of my favourites, and it was probably something I really wouldn't want to make a film about, because there are only one or two films that I really, really love in this genre, and they're like Nobody's Business, Alan Berliner, in case anyone's seen that. Fantastic film. But this sort of, I didn't want to make a sort of cozy, intimate, sort of chat with my immigrant parents about their experience. Couldn't imagine anything worse. But I had the Super 8, and that Super 8 and the audio archive that I had, I knew was just much bigger than my family, and had was so epic in the story it told and spanned so many years. So I viewed it more, to be honest, from an external perspective, from without the family, that I just had a tremendous archive, and that whatever difficulties would follow making a film about my family, I would need to do so. But I wanted to be very, very clear in how I crafted that documentary and how I told that story, so that it would be something cinematic and beautiful and considered, rather than just a chat between me and my parents. Yeah. So that was the main thing, to craft something about that and to make that the epic quality of all of this come through. Mm-hmm. It was just a shame. It wasn't about my family. If I discovered that in somebody else's or in some other context, I would have made it too.
Okay. And Theo, what got you interested in the family?
Well, first of all, I think that, thanks for having me. And hello. And I'm probably the only person here who doesn't live in this country and who is not bilingual. So if I don't find the right words and I talk rubbish, you let me know, please. I'm interested in stories. Or in as a base for stories in relationships, as a metaphor for cultural phenomenons and social issues and everything there is. And I just think that the strongest bonds we have are within the family. So the stakes always are really high within the family, and also of course due to the superficial or the first level of what you see when we see the film. You say, okay, it's about honor killing mechanisms and so on and so forth. That has to do with family dynamics per se. So it was pretty obvious it would be set in a family.
Yeah.
Well, I was interested in, the media portrayal of so-called honor crimes in the middle of Europe and in Germany. At the time I decided to make that film, was in a very black and white way. I was happy that it had, that it was on the radar finally, to an extent that I think should have been long ago. But how it was portrayed was always that it's the monster father, it's the monster brother, it's the bad and the good that just wouldn't fit my concept of humanism, that we're not talking about traumatic experiences for everybody involved. And so I was trying to create a story with, you know, empathizing as much as possible with every single member of the family. And I think that's the only way you can approach family conflict, is with the biggest empathy for everybody involved as a mirror of society and as our global community.
So there's already something coming out. We're looking at family a little bit as universal and as microcosm.
Well, as a microcosm,
yeah,
microcosm for
the society.
Yeah.
Would you say that is the case with your film as well, Gareth? Have you approached it in that way? It's a very intimate story, a very personal one.
Yes, I mean, I think inevitably it's a microcosm in that I couldn't afford the macrocosm.
you mean without outside the house?
Absolutely, the house was all I could afford, so I had no choice but a microcosm. It's amazing how filmmakers tend to do what they can do, but that's the next question, I know. It is a microcosm, but I suppose in a way I come to it from the inside out rather than from the outside in. I am a very, as we all are, very passionate sort of family person. I think by the time I finally retire, age 70, I will have spent 40 years raising kids. I'm very, very interested in the way the family functions, not as it were, not just as a social unit, but also as a creative unit, and as a unit to a certain extent apart, and in approaching it as a unit apart, I hope that it does de facto, if you like, become a microcosm, because nothing else exists. So you have to think about everything else outside through what is there and shown. And so, if you like, I've concentrated very much on character as inner voice, if you like, character as intimate experience of oneself in relation to other very, very closely linked individuals. And I think in doing that, although I've, you know, kind of earlier on in my career as television director, I did, for instance, quite a lot of social realist stuff, like, as Daniela said, The Trial of Klaus Barbie, or Shalom Salam, which I wrote and directed for the BBC, which I think was probably the first venture, almost in 1988, into multicultural drama, in which I cast the young Ayub Khan. Yes, he was actually sketching out East is East while we were shooting. Yes, which is very funny to look back at. But in this, I suppose now, possibly later, you know, kind of going through possibly a quietist phase, I am more interested, I suppose, in very intimate cinema, more related possibly to Bergman, Pasolini, and that, and just actually seeing whether we can't enlarge styles and traditions of British cinema slightly more in more continental directions.
Mm. Now, you, of course, said in an interview, Leslie, that was with regard to East is East, you said, I might be Jewish, but in George I saw a man who might have been my father.
He was my father.
I felt that here was a story that spoke to everyone, not just an Anglo-Asian audience. So, again, the idea is universal, but what about ethnic specificities?
Well, I do feel that East is East and West is West are very personal to me. I feel they are my story, and they are, as I say, incredibly personal in that way. I mean, to some degree, as a producer, I have to feel that, because I spend 4 years... I'm not a normal producer. I'm not normal. I don't have, you know, balls that I juggle up in the air and have several projects going at once. And I do one at a time. I can only do it that way. And I can only do it when I'm 100% utterly convinced and passionate about the piece of work. And partly because, you know, the obstacles are so immense that you want to give up at every turn. And the only thing that can keep you going is that faith. And since as a producer you don't earn anything at all until the day the film is actually greenlit. So you'll, you know, develop a film for 2-3 years and earn nothing, zero, during development. So in order to keep the faith and keep going for 4 years, you have to really love it and believe in it. And there's nothing you can feel more strongly about than what directly, you know, affects you and is very personal to you. And as I say, those two films are. Every single one of my feature films, and I hadn't had this thought until you just asked the question of all of us a moment ago, are about a family. There isn't one of the films I've made that isn't. The television films I produced were campaigning, politically campaigning films, one about the Birmingham Six, one about a rogue landlord. But all my feature films have been about families. I've just realised that. Yeah, but George Kahn is my father. He's not similar to. He is my father. We had a circumcision issue in our family. He was this patriarch who insisted on, you know, his values, and tried to impose them in a very unintelligent way. And I was, you know, the rebel child who would not accept any of it and renounced it all. And like Ayub, I've got to a sort of far greater point of maturity where, you know, I can see him for what he is. And I think you were saying about good and evil, and I couldn't agree more. You cannot make drama about characters who are black or white or good or bad. You know, we are all human beings. And ultimately, I make films because I love people. Yeah. And I make films to tell people about how we can make ourselves and our communities and our relations better. And the family seems to be the way I choose to tell it because I had such a terrible upbringing.
So it's art in order to overcome the trauma.
Probably.
Yeah. Which is, yeah.
Probably.
Good enough reason.
Yes, yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think that may well be absolutely true.
Just thinking a bit about kind of the industrial context that you've worked in. And Leslie, I wonder if you can say a little bit more about the different contexts of East is East, which came out of a particular kind of multicultural context, I think, in terms of policy, cultural diversity policy, and West is West, which I think in terms of policy frameworks is actually very different now. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about that, the different contexts of industrial context of working in those two different decades.
When I was trying to raise the financing for East is East, it was absolutely and utterly impossible. I had only one offer of finance, other than the one that finally helped make the film, which was Film 4. I approached every single distributor the world over. I mean, I worked tirelessly. Nobody wanted to know. They all said, this is a ghetto film. It's a niche film. It will only be seen by Asians in Southall. There is no possible interest in any audience in the world in this film. What the only offer I had was from Duncan Kernwevy, who saw the merits of the script and saw the potential of it. He's a very clever producer. But he wanted the son who flees the marriage in East is East, Nazir, because he's gay. He wanted the film to be much more about the gay son. And I just said, no, I'd rather not make it because that's not what the film is about. And stuck it out, and thank God I did, but there was only one company at that time who, they didn't believe the film would do well. They believed they would lose their money, but they had this cultural brief. It was the very, very beginnings of the buzzword cultural diversity, you know, in Britain. And Film 4 said, we have to make films that are culturally inclusive of all of our communities in our population. So they said, we will make it, but you can have this pittance to make it with and not one penny more because we're going to lose it all. And we're doing it for a good cause, but it's not a commercial film. And I said, are you insane? This is a massively commercial film. Everyone across the world will recognize themselves, their families, and it's ultimately recognizably universal. And so it was proved, but at the time, huge resistance. Now, West is West was in some ways as difficult to get the money together for because we were in a recession. So, you know, this was like 3 years ago I started looking for the money for it. No money to be had. Companies closing down left, right and centre. UK Film Council turned it down because they said, Sally Kaplan, head of the Premier Fund, said, the character of George Kahn is unsympathetic. So help me God. So I said, okay, then I'll go to the New Cinema Fund, which is the more sort of experimental and, you know, and get less money but get some. And I went to them and they said, nope, the film is too commercial. We don't make commercial films. We make auteur-driven films. So I couldn't even get money from the British Film Council, from the UK Film Council. Thank God for BBC. And I couldn't find any other money, but BBC were bringing like 30% of the budget. So I thought, if with the pedigree of East is East, if I cannot persuade individuals, high net worth individuals who loved East is East, to put their money in, then I'd be amazed. And indeed, that's what's happened. So for the first time ever in my history as a producer, I have got private finance. 70% of this film was made with individuals' hard-earned money, which is also why I've been working tirelessly since last July, because I won't sleep until they get it all back plus. Because there is a moral responsibility. And it was incredibly hard to raise the money. Now, the very weird thing that has happened is there is another sort of institutional policy which is making itself felt in the distribution side of the industry. And this is my huge bugbear. Do I tell it now or later?
No.
I think now.
Okay, so look, here's the thing. Film did amazingly well in the UK. We opened in Toronto, where, you know, that was our big platform for sales. We could not have had a more stunning, wonderful, auspicious beginning, because our gala premiere on the opening weekend of the Toronto Film Festival had 1,800 people in the audience, and they gave it a 5-minute standing ovation. And they laughed throughout, and they cried, and it was a fabulous, fabulous debut for the film. So we thought, okay, great, we're home and dry. We just have to sell the world now. You know, the territories around the world, you sell them in bundles. We had two big American distributors following the film before that, and they just wanted to see it. They saw it in those circumstances. I thought, okay, done deal. They started talking specific negotiating for the film the following day, and then they both went very, very quiet for several days. All the major US distributors have turned this film down because
I stood with my executive.
They either feel it will
BBC, Jane Wright,
alienate their audiences, very, or very the world's a very different place now. You know, Pakistan is the number one enemy.
I'm not going to name, well, maybe I'm
word
sure,
for word.
But anyway, no, I won't name names.
They deserve
the American
to be named.
People
anyway,
will not take kindly to a film set in Pakistan.
She called him. I was
and
standing
that has
there.
Been
the echo.
On
for God's sake, if ever there was a nation in this entire
say,
world which is made up of immigrants,
said, what's happened?
Made up
why,
of people
you know,
who have one foot in
quiet,
one country
said, well,
and the
I'm
other
really
foot
sorry,
in another.
You know,
so, you know, I mean, this just makes me feel ill to my stomach.
You love the film.
It's pig ignorant.
We were talking specifically.
It's bigoted and it's very unhelpful to
internally in LA
films in general and the film industry. And so actually what I did was then persuade my finances, I was so shocked by this, to
the
put another £12,000 in, because that's what it
cost
to make a test
know,
screening
it's
in the States.
Just not culturally.
And so help me God, I've got 38 pages of test screening results, a report from First Movies, which is a very prominent test screening company in the States. 90% of that American test audience said they would highly recommend people to see it on the big screen, which you can't have a more dream score than that. 77% scored it in top two boxes, excellent or very good. Good doesn't count, by the way. Only excellent or very good, 77%. And when asked if you liked the film, why did you like it, which 77% of the film of the audience really did, they said, because it was set in Pakistan, we found this really refreshing. It showed us that people are people everywhere, etc. You know, various comments of that sort throughout these 30 years. So the distributors don't know their public. They don't know what people want, and they are keeping these choices away from the public. That's the kind of institutional disease that we're working with now.
Okay, thanks for that.
Very long answer, sorry.
We might get a chance to talk about kind of burdens of representation and stereotyping and expectations a little bit later. Mm. But Sandhya, I wonder if I can ask you, if you can just remind us kind of how I for India got supported, and also currently in thinking maybe about future projects or current projects, what are the particular opportunities or obstacles with regards to funding?
Okay, well, I'd made a short from the archive material as my graduation film, and hadn't had any screenings in the UK at all of it, despite the fact that it was very specific British archive of some significance. So then I decided to make a feature of it. I had a producer who, strangely enough, was Italian, just because I just felt I had a better communication with him. I'd gone to see a few UK producers who weren't particularly interested, definitely didn't like the style, because it was my short was quite experimental and purely archive-based, and didn't like film graduates, no idea. I had a lot of, I didn't have much success in the UK initially. And when we looked for finance, I had got immediately 50% of the budget from ZDF Arte, French-German channel, which was amazing because I'd come straight out of film school. I had one conversation with the commissioning editor. She'd seen the short. And that was it. It was no more questions. It was fine. She trusted me. It was an experienced producer with me. That was all she needed. She also had quite an experimental slot, to be totally fair. It was a La Lucarne. It's on late at night on Arte, and then if it does well on there, they can screen it at an earlier time. So, but still, she took the risk. And then we tried to find the financing, obviously, the rest of it in the UK, being a UK historical document. And guess what? You know, nothing. We went to see Nick Fraser at Storyville, BBC, and it was a very interesting meeting because there was some, you know, some sort of murmurings of interest about the fact that this might be an interesting document for their audience. But, you know, I was out of film school and, you know, God, don't we make pretentious films there, and really, could I be trusted to deliver a feature for them? And then it was suggested that I should co-direct the film with somebody. And then they asked me which filmmakers I liked, and, you know, I had a mentor at film school, Kim Longinotto, one of Britain's most, you know, fantastic and successful documentary makers, who, you know, I love. But the idea of her sitting in my semi, next to me while my mum's praying and filming that, was just not right at all. And luckily, you know, my producer was great, and he just said, you know, BBC, either, you know, keep your money or don't, or, you know, or give it, but please don't make such preposterous suggestions. And then Channel 4 something, I think they had a multicultural there at some time. She somehow didn't like the project, don't quite know what. So that conversation also was aborted. But this was 1.5 years of dialogue, which was a real waste of time, to be honest, because otherwise I think we could have... We were just assuming that the rest of the money, or at least a good chunk of it, would be found in the UK. And it wasn't. So the rest of it was taken from German regional funds.
Okay. So sort of fast-forwarding, thinking about now.
Yeah.
If you, are there kind of differences in terms of the climate, do you think?
I don't know, not in terms... I think a lot of it was also stylistic, you see. A lot of it was about authorship and formatting in documentaries, which I think is probably worse rather than better right now. So I don't think so, no. Mm-hmm. Sorry, very bleak picture.
But. Now, you've already conveyed the impression that, ZDF and RT were quite forthcoming. What was your experience when you tried to produce your film, which is your first feature as well for you?
It was much easier than I supposed it would be, mm-hmm. in a sense that I came with no short on my reel, and being a blonde actress and saying, this is me directing, producing, and having written that script, which is not up for some debate whatsoever. And they had basically nothing. I mean, what should they give me their trust and money for? So there was no real base apart from, I think, the script they really liked, mm-hmm. and just the commitment that they probably felt. And I wanted them to invest in the film because they really wanted to be part of telling this story without having any stars attached and, you know, being a debut on all three, mm-hmm. you know, fields. I was very, very, very fortunate. I mean, I don't know how many film students are in here or if you all are, but Germany did have, you know, this reputation of, okay, here's German stupid money, which was tax, you know, those tax funds. And I'm sure you know a lot about that. And there still is a very different system now, sure. The DFFF. And it's not as stupid any longer, but it's still there. And we are very fortunate in the sense that we still have that. And I've traveled so many countries with this film, and I've met so many wonderful filmmakers from Pakistan to New York who have partially nothing except tremendous talent. And I just feel very fortunate that I was able to make it in Germany, and, you know, coming there as an Austrian 12 years ago, and that people trusted me and believed in what I was trying to convey, and that I made them happy with the film that we made together. So it's been quite a pleasing experience.
And tell me, what about the authenticity issue, which often pertains to you make a Turkish-German film, and but you're not Turkish, you know. Was that at any stage considered an obstacle or...
By the people who gave the money?
Yes, first
no,
of all.
No, not at all.
No, not at all.
Not at all, because we had a very multicultural team. No, not at all. And I think they would have been in the wrong position to do so, because in order to raise that question, there should be more people with a migration background in those positions who make decisions, and I think that should be step one in Germany. Since this is not the case,
yeah.
It would be throwing with stones out of a glass house, you know what I mean?
And several years ago, when I spoke to the Filmförderung,
In Berlin.
Spoke to them in Berlin because I wanted to find out about special diversity policies. And they said, no, we haven't, that was several years ago.
No.
Haven't got that. We kind of decide on funding by merit. We haven't got a special diversity policy to...
Like a quote or...
Quota or...
Yeah.
Is that still the same?
Yeah, it is still the same because we have, I'm sure you know, we have juries.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 7 to 9 people who read a tremendous amount of scripts and projects and who are, you know, directors, producers, distributors, actors, who are in this, politicians, who are in this jury, and they decide on which projects get funded and which don't. So it's, even if you're, you know, even if you're sleeping with the head of the FFI, you wouldn't get a fund, you know what I mean? It's
yeah.
it's professional looking
yeah.
at your work and what you want to do and at the combination of projects you have and people working on it. So, I mean, I'm sure, you know, if Constantine Film comes up, if a really big company
yeah.
comes up and it's a film that's so obviously mainstream with big stars attached, chances that it will get funded are pretty big. You know what? So
mm.
I mean, of course, there is certain rules,
mm.
But I think compared to all other systems that I'm familiar with, maybe except the French one, it's a very luxurious position for filmmakers and producers to be in Germany
mm.
right now, and it won't last forever. It's
yeah.
there now, and I would highly appreciate if we could open the doors even more in order to strengthen the European film, have more exchange, and you know, because I think it's so important.
Britain isn't even a member of EuroMarche.
I read
it's
that
disgusting.
In your interview, and
I haven't been for ages.
Could
disgusting.
You explain to me why? Because I
because they don't
myself.
Really value film. The success of governments in this country just
and they certainly don't value Europe.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
It's a double whammy, in fact. You're right. Absolutely. Yeah.
Germany invests 60 million every year in film. We invest 18 million.
And dwindling, right?
France
18 million
and
dwindling.
France is about 30.
Hmm. So it's in between.
Yeah.
Gareth,
but not as high as one would think. Not as high as one would think.
We're a satellite of America.
Mm, sure, absolutely.
So,
yes.
You know,
right.
It's only American films that... I mean, I had... Can I tell another very, very quick sort of... It's not a case history. It won't be a long one, this. But just two things. You mentioned going with half your budget from France and looking for the other half here. I had one film which I've never managed to make called In Search of the Assassin. I had 50% of my budget, $10 million film, so a big one. 50% of my budget from TF1 International in France, who were going to be sales agents on the film and bought the French rights. And I went to the UK Film Council, Robert Jones was then running the Premier Fund, asking for the other 50%. I left that application worse off than I was when I applied, because he picked up the phone behind the producer's back.
No.
I've looked at your sales estimates. They're very inflated. I'm very optimistic to think this film is going to sell for this much money around the world. This was like 6 years ago or something. And TF1 called me and said, wait a minute, if your British funders have no confidence in this, we're dropping our 50% to 25%. So I left without money from the UK Film Council, but a big fat dent. I left with 25% when I'd come to them with 50. You know, that's what we're doing. This country is disastrous in terms of their lack of value of independent British films. Sorry, I get so angry.
I think that's incredible to hear. Is it one person deciding if you get...
It has been, yes.
It has been.
Absolutely.
So it's not a jury or...
No, it's one person.
Which
one person has headed up those funds.
It's so subjective.
Now, it has changed now. They've been, because of, you know, the cuts and all of that, they've now been pretty much dismantled and moved to BFI, haven't they? I mean, I don't quite know what they're doing with the UK Film Council, if it's all sorted out yet. But
It's gone, but musical chairs, various people have actually now found themselves at the BFI in the same jobs.
In the same jobs, yeah.
Gareth, I've got a question for you with your Babylon hat on.
Can I just complete this yes. on the... Because I recognise all of this. I've been through all of this on other projects, and I have very serious concerns simply about the process by which films get authorised. I don't think films should have to be authorised, because there is, if not implicit censorship, and that certainly takes place, there is most certainly an implicit consensus building. I think consensus is a disaster for art, and film, if it possibly can, should resist it. I'd wasted enough time on exactly the kind of shenanigans that Leslie has described, and I didn't want to do it again. So the structure of Desire was cooperative, and my partner and I put in the cash ourselves. End of story.
Good for you.
End of story. We didn't even approach these people. I didn't want to talk to them. And frankly, they're such mediocrities. They'll waste your time, steal your money, stab you in the back. I wouldn't go anywhere near them, frankly. So basically, we made the film the way we wanted to make the film, and nobody is responsible except my producer, occasional co-writer, and indeed my composer, not of the songs you heard, of course, which are by the fabulous Umu Sangari from Mali. But basically, we did it all ourselves, partly because I knew that as soon as we started talking about this project to people on committees, they would point that it had absolutely no ostensible social relevance at all, and I think relevance is the death of art, I'm afraid. I fortunately have made a film which is utterly irrelevant, and I'm very glad for people to watch it on that basis so that they can find inside it what actually speaks to them. There is no hook. There is no newspaper article that could be written about it. It is a totally private world, but one which is shaped and fashioned by, I think, the big, big pressures of our day. I could go into detail about that, but I won't, because the conversation ought to move on. Having discovered that we'd made the film like this, we then, by extension, discovered we also had to distribute the film like this, and that's also what we've done.
Have you made your money back? Will you make your money back?
I think we will make our money back, and as you, I feel a debt to all of those who contributed their work, either as investment, and now between them own 50% of the film, and those who were paid less than they should have been, but nonetheless did earn something. And I'm very happy to say that everybody who took part in the film is very, very happy with the result, because those who did invest their creative effort have got a film that they're very proud of, which they otherwise would never have had. Mm. And they say that they're very pleased with it, whether they get paid anything or not. I think they will in the end. But we're only just at the end of the UK release. We've now got to do foreign sales, we've got to do DVD release, broadcast and all of that, and I think the money will start coming in, but it's a bit of a hair-raising roller coaster, really. But we're already preparing the next one to shoot this summer, I hope, because if you just do one, it drops. If you do two, you're starting to build a brand, and unfortunately, you know, kind of even in a narco free market temperament like myself, you have to actually think about where it's going, what you're doing, how you're presenting it, how you're going to sell it. I would prefer to live dangerously like that, frankly, than waste my time with these people.
Can we, just bearing in mind that we probably have to be out of here by five, just move back to the area of representation? We heard a lot since this morning about stereotypes, and also I think everybody here at this table is really keen to offer these more nuanced pictures which avoid the burden of representation and stereotyping. Now, Theo, with your film, it's set in the Turkish Muslim community in Germany. It's about honor killings. It's about a victimized Turkish German woman.
And men.
And men, yes, as well. I just wanted to ask you, how does it inscribe itself in that earlier tradition, and how does it avoid stereotyping?
Well, I think by approaching, you know, the characters with as much empathy as possible, as I said before, I think that's you cannot tell a tragedy without empathizing with both sides, as you mentioned before, because there is no black and white, no right or wrong.
Did everybody who saw your film realize or respond, not realize, respond emotionally in a way that they felt empathetic about the father and the brothers?
Yes, I would say the absolute majority did. And the film was shown in 48 countries on 6 continents, I think since yesterday, 99 international film festivals since last April. I didn't travel all of them, and it sold to 30 territories, but I traveled to some countries and very different cultural backgrounds. And what happened at the Q&As is that people open up, they tell their stories, and they deliberately share their very personal, intimate associations about family, about their relationship with their father. So, yeah, I think that we did achieve to reach people there across borders, across lingual borders and ethnic and cultural.
And in the German press, all the reviews, and I think in that way your film is misunderstood, all the reviews see this film as a Turkish-German story.
And that was not
your intention.
I didn't have to. Well, it's not all. No, it wasn't actually all the media. It wasn't all the feuilleton. But I'm pretty. You see, I'm so fed up with this whole. How many generations do I have to be in Germany in order to be German? 5, 6, 8, 10. I'm more of a foreigner than my husband, who is Zülküf Alada, and who was born in Van. And people go like, so your husband is Turkish? No. Fuck, he's German. I'm Austrian, by the way, and my mom's Jewish, and my father's whatever, you know? And the Turkish filmmaker and the German filmmaker, I think it's about filmmaking, it's about storytelling, it's about what we bring as human beings to the table. Of course it's important how have we been socialized and what's our roots, you know? But it is just too much Kasteldenken, whatever the English word is.
It's a very important question. In diaspora studies, the question is, how long is a diaspora a diaspora? When do they stop being a diaspora?
Yeah.
So in a way, I've read your interviews as well, where you've said, you know, I don't want the first, second, third, and nth generation of Turkish Germans. They should stop talking
labeling
about
it in
that way. Mm.
I mean, it's kind of sad if you see so many people struggle by even trying to find a term to address.
Yes.
What's the terminology? What words to use? Migrants of the fourth generation.
In Denmark, where I now live, actually, you're not the only one who's not any longer from here. I live in Copenhagen because my husband is Danish and we decided to educate our children there rather than in England. But in Denmark, they have this really insulting new phrase, I think. They call them nydanska, which means new Danes.
Oh, yeah.
So patronizing. Interesting.
It's
many other respects, you know, the Danes have a very egalitarian and sophisticated socialist society that, you know, I admire a great deal about it. But in terms of their immigration policy, their view of, non-Danes in their society, they're a disaster. They're terrible. Mm.
Sandhya, what about you in terms of expectations? Do you think there's any expectations of you as a Asian woman to make particular kinds of film? Or do you just completely avoid even thinking about that inane politics?
Well, no, it was definitely because we had quite a lot of press after I for India, which opened up quite a lot of doors. But, you know, and I was thinking about doing a fiction at that point, and it was all sort of, I don't know, pre-concluded for any discussion that would be some sort of Gurinder Chadha type, you know, style, and that there was a bit of space and I could, you know, go in there and do something along those lines, which I really didn't want to do, which is probably why I've been hanging around for so long since the last film. But I think it's definitely an expectation of that. Is that kind of from audiences or funders or what's...
Funders, I think audiences don't mind what you make as long as it's good, right? Mm-hmm. And it touches them.
It seems in terms of West is West, Leslie, that in a way it was expected to fulfil an impossible set of expectations, you know, to be funny, to respond to this post 9/11 climate in some way, to address social concerns. Can you take all of that on board when you're also trying to sort of realise artistic ambitions and what a sequel's attempting to do?
No, well, first of all, if I'm honest, there was only one consideration which I felt responsibly I had to take on board, or I would be shooting us in the foot and creating problems for us down the line, and that was on the comedy expectation. Because it is a sequel. Now, I will never make a film to prescription, ever, 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 but this was a very particular beast, and I knew that when we came down the line to distribution of the film, they would come what may distribute it as a comedy. They would, because, because the first film was marketed in that way and successful in that way, and we were not going to escape that. Now, mercifully, thankfully, Ayub Khan Din is an utterly wonderful writer in whose veins the blood of comedy runs. He cannot help but express himself that way. So, you know, I knew it was never going to be a sort of injection of trying to force something, force feed him on, you know, put comedy in there, make it. But we had that discussion very early on, and I said, listen, we've got to be grown up and mature about this, and just know that that is what the expectation is going to be. I absolutely do not want us to do any kind of repetition. In fact, we were both completely and utterly determined that it should be a standalone film. It is a much more serious film. It's a much more layered, much deeper film, and it is its own thing, you know. We didn't work with the original director of East is East because it all boiled down to what is the definition of a sequel. He felt a sequel has to deliver on the promise of the first one and repeat. So he wanted the film to be about George arranging the marriage of his son in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And to us, that was reductive and wrong, because pretty much every Asian-themed film you ever see is about arranged marriages. So that's dull and boring and, you know, cliched. And we did not want to repeat. We particularly wanted to move on. And there was this whole amazing other chapter in the annals of his real family history that we wanted to tell. But the interesting thing that, Claudia, you started speaking about in your paper, and it is a fact that there was there were absolutely quite a number of reviews which it didn't say they wish the film had touched on, you know. They said its flaw and failing was that it did not. So, for instance, just to pick on one, the Guardian review... And I would name his name if I could, but I have wiped it from my memory. Well, that reviewer wrote a, you know, pretty positive, constructive, good review about the film, and then came to his last paragraph and said, however, the fatal flaw of this film is that it tells us nothing about Muslims in Britain today and in the post 9/11 world and terrorism.
Good God, he didn't.
So help me God. So help me God.
I think, quote, fails to get to grips with the troubles facing British Muslims in Pakistan was also part of that.
And Pakistan, yeah. I mean, it is, you know, I just think, go and get another job, mate. You know, what, how, the film is set in 1976, for God's sake.
One interesting thing, Leslie, from those two clips is that the story has moved on 4 years, but Ayub's maturity as a writer has moved on 20 years.
I agree.
So one has a very, very strange feeling of actually this being another generation.
Absolutely.
Reincarnate in slightly ghostly form.
Spot on, because... And that is why Sally Kaplan was so wrong, because George Kahn is not unsympathetic. The absolute opposite. No. You weep for this man in this film because...
He wasn't unsympathetic in East is East.
Well, I don't think he was. No. But, you know, even if he was...
And they would sympathy label
tyrannical.
Is such rubbish.
It's pathetic. Mm. But anyway...
I think... Sorry. I'm just mindful again of the time, and our audience
we could go on forever, couldn't we?
Will want to ask a few questions before we wrap up. So maybe not, but if we can open it up to the audience.
Can we have some figures for the budgets? Because we've had percentages.
2.5 million pounds, same amount as East is East was made for 10 years previously.
35,000.
1.8 euros.
Oh, the little documentary baby, 250,000 euros.
Oh. Can I say one thing about the representation issue? Because, and regarding funding, or specifically for my documentary, I found that there was a real reluctance to tell a first generational story without myself acting as an intermediary in that story. So I think a lot of the resistance or a lot of the pressure I was put under to put myself in the film and have me being the sort of person who explains and justifies and comments upon my father's in particular experience was something that really irritated me. That I had a lot of dialogue about, that ultimately Ate let me do. But I noticed that even from a film school level, even at my graduation film, the clear idea was there that your father's direct talking to the audience with his voice about his experience without any mitigation from you is going to be unappealing. So I think funding-wise, that was a very strong... You know, already it's alien enough. But at least, you know, let's throw in some youth in there and that will, you know, help us get in there. But otherwise, it just seemed a little too exotic or too far off.
This is the sort of thing. This is the sort of thing that Babylon is there to fight.
Right, okay.
Although your father is presented in a kind of, in so many very, very humorous scenes, how British he is, chatting across the garden fence about the weather, the gardening and so forth. But he was still not...
Just his experience, I think, wasn't seen to be relevant enough to whoever you might market it to, even an art house documentary audience.
Yeah.
So it was just something I noticed very strongly, that it was always been there, that you know, put yourself in it and you should be giving a voiceover and blah, blah, blah. And that was just one thing.
So, but Gareth, you were just saying it's just what you experience with Babylon still.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I mean, the films that are allowed to be made and those that are not allowed to be made, I think, can best be exampled by an experience we had with a very talented writer called Faisal Qureshi, who's gone on to be associate producer on Four Lions and various other things. But he had a wonderful, wonderful script about special rendition from the point of view of the victim. Would anybody look at it? Absolutely not. Special rendition is to be done by the raptors, not by the captives. I mean, I rest my case. That's all I've got to say.
We should also just come back to your point earlier about stereotypes in East is East. Was it not yours? Yeah, sorry.
No.
Okay, it was... Oh, I see. Okay, well, I'll talk about that anyway, because it has been made as a point by some people. The fact that in East is East, a lot of the Pakistani characters were to some people, relatively negatively portrayed. And I know that that upset a lot of people. I mean, Ayub and I never kind of... tried in any conscious way to reverse that or address it even in West is West. But I think certainly people have come up to me and said they're thrilled that that balance is redressed for them because the Pakistani characters are so dignified and beautiful and, you know, and warm. And just the thing about films having to be ambassadors is really frustrating for us as filmmakers, because, you know, at the end of the day, the reason the two girls who George proffers as brides to his two sons are ugly is because it wouldn't be funny if they weren't. And it's as simple as that. It is as simple as that. In comedy, certain rules apply. The girls have to be ugly or it won't be funny. So that's it. You know, a film cannot be an ultimate ambassador for this race or that. You know, it's difficult. It's difficult. And actually, it was a real story, and it really was Ayub's story, and it was accurate to his experience of it. That's the other side of the coin, in a sense.
I think we have to wrap up here. I should like to thank, first of all, our panelists here at the roundtable discussion for their complimentary vantage point for this very lively discussion, also for flying in from faraway places and flying back to Meerut and Mumbai and everywhere else, so it's truly transnational in that respect. And also for just kind of adding your perspective and your inside view to the discussion that we've had earlier on today, I think has been tremendously valuable. So I thank you all very, very much for coming here and sharing your ideas with us. I should also like to thank all the speakers this morning for some wonderful, really fascinating presentations and really opening up the scope through Hollywood and Bollywood and going beyond Europe. Finally, I should like to thank our audience for being here today. It's a Saturday and there are a lot of commitments, and so I'm really grateful that you've made your way and spent the day here with us in the auditorium, and I hope that you will be able to go to the Cine Lumière and see Féo Aladag's film and join in the Q&A, where I think we have some other issues to discuss then. I should also like to thank SOAS for giving us this amazing space in the heart of London. In particular, my thanks, Jane is there. My particular thanks go to Jane, who has given tremendous support in the whole organization and the publicity and great attention to detail, and she's always been there at the other end of the line. So thank you so much, Jane. I should also like to thank my own department for their support, especially Jackie Marty, who has a very similar role to Jane, and for supporting this entire project, the Diasporic Family in Cinema, in numerous ways. And of course to the AHRC for giving me a grant that made this conference and the project possible. Finally, I should like to remind you that we haven't got the feedback forms yet, or have you? Yeah, okay. Jane will give you, as you go out, some feedback forms. And if you come to the film, please fill them in kind of in the break before the film or so. You can send them back to me. It's a kind of feedback form which isn't so much about was the food good and was the organization good. It's much more to do with the content and how you responded to the film viewings and a little bit about your perception. So it's a different feedback form. And finally, I should also like to remind you of the website, farflungfamilies.net, and I hope that you browse the website and leave some comments. I'm always terribly grateful for some interactivity on the website. And maybe you'll find something there. You will certainly find, not immediately, but in a few weeks' time, hopefully, podcasts of whatever you've heard today, in case you want to go back and listen some more or take some further notes. And I hope that this site will also be a forum to continue the dialogue that we've begun today. So thank you very much.